And first being chastened in many ways, since his sins were manifold, springing up from the root of evil, and by a variety of causes was he chastened, and at various times, by word and by law, by prophets, and by benefits, by plagues, floods, fire, war, victory, defeat, by signs from heaven, and by signs in the air, upon the earth and upon the sea, by the unexpected vicissitudes of men and cities and nations, all combining to this end, that wickedness might be exterminated. He then began to be in need of a stronger remedy, for his evils were growing worse: mutual slaughter, adulteries, perjuries, crimes against nature, and then the first and last of all evils, idolatry, and the transferring of worship from God to creatures. And since these called for a greater divine aid, they also received a Creator. This was the Word, the Son of God, who is before all ages, invisible, incorporeal, the beginning of the beginning, light from light, the source of life and of immortality, the imprint of the pattern, the immovable seal, the unchanging image, the measure of the Father and His Word. He, I say, came to His own image, and there for the sake of our flesh took flesh, and for my soul's salvation joined Himself to a rational soul, and through like purified like, becoming man in all things, sin alone excepted. He was conceived by the Virgin, who by the Spirit had been prepared beforehand in both body and soul. For it was fitting the generation should be honored, and that virginity should be yet more honored. He came forth God together with that which He had assumed, one from two contrary things, flesh, namely, and spirit, one of which bestowed divinity, the other received it. O new and unheard of commingling! O strange and wondrous union! He who is begins to be. He who is uncreated is brought forth. The unconfined is contained within a reasoning soul, placed between divinity and gross flesh. He who gives riches becomes poor, for He becomes poor in my flesh, that I may be enriched in His divinity. He who is full empties Himself. For a time He empties Himself of His glory, that I may share of His fullness. What are the riches of His goodness? What is this mystery that is round about me? I received His image within me, and I did not guard it. He takes to Himself my body, that He may save the image and give immortality to the body. He bestows on us a new relationship, more wondrous by far than the first. In that He gave us what was a better nature, in this He takes to Himself what is worse. This act is more godlike than the first. To men of understanding, it is a sublimer action. But perhaps some among you, more impatient and eager for the feast, will say, "Where is this leading to? Spur your horse to the goal. Speak to us about the festival, and why are we here sitting today?" That is what I shall do, though I have begun from a somewhat more exalted starting point, being forced to do so both by reason and by inclination. Nor will there be any harm if we also add a few words on the name itself of the Pasch, for the sake of those who love what is good and beautiful, for this will be acceptable to their ears. This Pasch, this great and venerable feast, is by the Hebrews called in their language Pascha, and it is evident the words meaning passing over, historically recalling their flight from Egypt to the land of Canaan. But if we consider the word in a spiritual sense, it refers to our progress and ascent from lower things to higher, and to the land of promise. And we find that what often happens in many places in Scripture, that certain words change from being obscure and become clearer in meaning, and from being harsh become refined, has taken place here. For some people, thinking that this is the name of the saving passion, in consequence altered the spelling, putting P for PH and K for CH, literally changing Phi and Kappa into Pi and Chi, and making a Greek word out of it, and called the day the Pasch. Use confirmed this, helped by people's ears, to which this had a more devout sound. But before our time, the Apostle has said that the whole law was but a shadow of things proposed and to come. And before this, when God was instructing Moses, when he was laying down laws concerning these things, he said, "Look that you do all things in accordance with the pattern shown thee on the mountain," that is, showing him things visible to the eye, which were as it were the shadow and outline of the things they could not see. And I believe that no detail was laid down without its purpose, without reason, nor anything mean or unworthy of God as lawmaker, or of Moses as his minister, or of the ministry of Moses, though it is difficult to discover the meaning behind each shadow and figure, down to each detail, such as those concerning the tabernacle, its measurements and material, the Levites and the priests who bore it, as well as all that was laid down concerning sacrifices and purifications and offerings, though these were clear, but only to those who were like Moses in virtue, or who resembled him in knowledge. For on the mountain itself God is seen by men, on the one hand by his own descent from his heavenly dwelling, on the other through raising men up from their own earthly lowliness, so that he who was incomprehensible may in some degree, and so far as is safe, be conceived by our mortal nature. For in no other way except by his divine aid can our dense body and fettered mind come to know God. Moreover, it is evident that all are not held worthy of the same rank or position, in relation to him, but one of one place and one of another, according, as I believe, to the degree of purification of each single one. Some were wholly forbidden to draw near, and only permitted to hear the voice coming from on high. These were like the beasts, in their way of life, and unworthy of sharing in the divine mysteries. We, however, take a middle way between those who are of a denser mind and those who are withdrawn and contemplative, so that we are neither dull or indifferent, nor yet more exact than is needed, and so fall short of a turn away from our true purpose, for the one manner is Jewish and unbecoming, the other the manner of a dreamer and soothsayer, and both to be rejected, shall treat of these things as best we can, not in any unusual manner, or one likely to appear ridiculous to the people. This is what we believe, that since we fell through original sin, and were brought down through our guilty pleasures, even to idolatry and to lawless bloodshed, it was necessary that we again restored through the merciful compassion of God, the Father, who would not suffer that such a work of his hands as man be lost to him. How then were we to be reformed? What was to be done? The sharper remedy of the surgeon was to be put aside as not persuasive, and which also would, because of our long-standing pride, only aggravate our condition. So it was by a gentle and kind method that we were to be restored. For a young tree bent one way will not endure to be suddenly bent the other way, or withstand the violence from the hand that bends it, for so it will rather be broken than made straight. Nor will a fiery horse, rising in age, endure the restraint of the bit without coaxing and gentle handling. And so the law is given to us as a help, as a space between God and idols, drawing us away from the one and towards the other. And it yields to us a little in the beginning, that it might may gain us the more. It allows us sacrifices for a time, that God may thereafter be established, when in a suitable time he will do away with sacrifices, in his wisdom gradually withdrawing them, and changing our dispositions, and leading us now formed and exercised in obedience to the way of the gospel. So the written law was given to us, and for these reasons leading us to Christ, and for me this is the purpose of the sacrifices. And that you may understand the depth of the wisdom of God and the riches of his unsearchable judgments, he did not leave them as wholly profane or profitless and consisting only of blood. But that great, and if I may say so in respect of its first nature, unsacrificable victim was commingled with the sacrifices of the law, and not for a small part of the race, nor for a time, but as an everlasting sacrifice for the whole world. And so a lamb was chosen, because of its innocence and as the clothing of our original nakedness. For such is the victim that is offered for us, the garment of our immortality, in fact and in name, a perfect victim, and not alone because of his divinity, than which nothing is more perfect, but also because of what he assumed and anointed with his divinity, which became as that which anointed it, and, if I may say so, an equal with God. A male victim, as offered for Adam, or rather as the stronger offered for the strong, since the latter had fallen into sin, and especially because there is in him nothing womanly, nothing unmanly. And then by natural force and power he burst forth from the maternal and virginal bonds, and as Isaiah announces, a male child was born from the prophetess, and of a year old as the son of justice, coming forth from heaven, and circumscribed by a visible nature, and turned towards himself. And a blessed crown of goodness, equal and like to himself, from on every side, but also giving life to the circle of the virtues, gently blended and intermingling one with another, as love and due order require. Blameless and unblemished, the healer of our defects and of the vices and stains that come from sin. For though he has borne our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet he himself suffered none of these things that needed to be healed in us. He was tempted in all things as we are, without sin. For he that persecuted the light shining in the darkness did not comprehend it. The custom of the first month is established, or rather a beginning of months, whether there was one before among the Jews from the beginning, or this began then, and because of the mystery this was made the first. And the tenth of this month, for this is the most complete number, and of units is the first perfect unit, and the parent of perfection. And it is observed until the fifth day, perhaps because my victim is the purifier of the five senses by which we have fallen, and around which is this warfare, since they are vulnerable to the goad of sin. And the victim was chosen, not alone from among the lambs, but also from among the lower kind of animals, which are on the left. For he is offered not alone for the just, but also for sinners, and perhaps even more for those, since we have greater need of mercy. Nor is it to be wondered at that a lamb is required for each house, but if it has it not, then let families join together as needed. For it is best that each one should, as far as possible, make a beginning of perfection within himself, and offer himself as his own living sacrifice to the God who has called him, and be devoted to God at all times and in all places. And if that cannot be, then let him be close to those who are kindred in virtue, and like us in our dispositions. For this rule seems to me to mean that where there is need, those nearest us should be sharers of our sacrifice. Then comes the sacred night, that is, of this present life now flowing, an enemy of that night into which the primeval darkness dissolves itself, and all things return to light, and the world which before was in disorder is now restored to order and form. Here we fly from Egypt, from dark persecuting sin, from Pharaoh the unseen tyrant, and from the cruel taskmasters, ascending to a world above this one. And we are freed from clay and the toil of making bricks, and from the straw and from the weakness of our own bodies, which in many is not made strong for all their straw-like calculations. Then the Lamb is slain, and the word and deed are sealed with the precious blood. That is our way of life and our actions, the sideposts of our doors. I mean of the movements and thoughts of our minds, which are opened and closed by contemplation, since there is a limit even to thoughts. Then the last and most grievous plague descends on the persecutors, one worthy of night, and Egypt mourns the firstborn of her thoughts and actions, which are also called in the Scriptures the seed of the Chaldeans, taken away and oppressed, and the children of Babylon dashed against the rocks. And the air is filled with the cry of the Egyptians, and their destroyer passes us by in fear and reverence of our anointing. Then for 7 days there is no leaven. This is the most mystical of numbers, and related to this world. That is the old and sour wickedness, not that which is life-giving and makes bread, so that we shall not lay up for ourselves any of the Egyptian or leavened paste, or any of the impious teachings of the Pharisees. Let them mourn. We shall eat of the Lamb, and in the evening, for Christ's passion came at the end of ages. And it was in the evening he shared his mystery with his disciples, undoing the darkness of sin. And we shall eat it, not boiled in water, but roasted at the fire, that our teaching may contain nothing impious, nothing diluted, or what may be easily undone, but that it may be well compacted together and stable, and purified by cleansing fire, free of what is superfluous, not over-subtle, and let us be helped by him, as by those live coals, enlightening and purifying our mind, which come from him who came to cast fire upon the earth, and also to hasten its kindling, so as to destroy our evil habits. Whatsoever then that is solid and nutritious in the word, let it be eaten with the inward and hidden parts of the mind, and given over to spiritual digestion, from the head even to the feet, that is, from the first reflections on the divinity to the last thoughts on the incarnation. Neither let us carry anything with us, neither shall there remain anything of it until morning. Since many of our mysteries cannot be carried to those outside, nor is there beyond this night any other purification. And putting off is not to be commended in those who become sharers of the word. For just as it is pleasing to God that your anger does not endure for the course of the day, but that it goes down before the sun goes down, whether you take this in the literal or the mystical sense. For it is not safe for us that the Son of Justice should go down on our anger. So we also should not let such food remain through the night, or lay it aside for the morrow. And whatever is a bone and hard to penetrate in thought, let it not be broken, that is badly interpreted or expressed. For let me say that in the Passion of Christ, according to the narrative, not a bone of Jesus was broken, and this though his executioners were eager for his death, because of the Sabbath. Nor should it be cast out to be snapped up, lest what is holy be given to dogs, that is, to those who tear the word to pieces, just as the shining pearl of the word should also not be cast before swine. But let it be consumed by fire, with which the burnt offerings were also consumed, being refined and preserved by the Spirit that searcheth all things, and not perishing upon the waters like the calf's head which Israel had hastily made for itself, and which was scattered in dust upon the waters in reproach for their hardness of heart. And it would not be right for us to pass over the manner of this eating, for the law does not, but deals with it in even in detail. Let us eat the victim in haste, eating it with unleavened bread and with wild lettuces, having our loins girt, having shoes on our feet, and lastly leaning on staves like old men. In haste, lest we fall into that error against which Lot was divinely warned, that we look not back, nor stay in all that country about, but that we save ourselves in the mountain, lest we be overtaken by the strange fire of Sodom, and because of our turning back to wickedness, which may arise through dallying, be turned into a pillar of salt. With wild lettuces, for a life that is lived in accord with God is bitter and arduous, especially to those who are beginning it, but more sublime than a life of pleasure. For though the new yoke is easy and the burden light, as you have heard, this is because of the hope and the reward, which far outweigh the sufferings of this life. If it were not so, who could not say that the gospel is more grievous and toilsome than the demands of the law? For while the law forbids the outcome of sinful acts, we are blamed for the causes, as if they were also acts. The law says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," but you may not even desire, awakening desire by intent and curious looks. "Thou shalt not kill," says the law. You, on the contrary, may not even return a blow, but must rather turn the other cheek to the smiter. How much closer to holy wisdom is this rather than the other? "Thou shalt not bear false witness," you may not swear at all, neither a great oath nor a small one, for an oath is the begetter of perjury. "Join not house to house," it says, "nor lay field to field, oppressing the poor, but you of your own will give away what you have justly acquired, and deprive yourself for the sake of the poor, so that you freely take up the cross and follow to where there is treasure unseen. Let the loins of irrational animals be loose and unbound, for they are without the reason that can dominate pleasure, though they know the right measure of natural inclination. But let that part of you which is the center of natural inclination, and which neighs, for by this term scriptures reprove shameful passion, be restrained by the girdle of moderation, so that being mortified in your members which are upon the earth, you may eat the pasch in purity, putting on the girdle of John, the precursor of the great announcer of truth. And I know of another girdle, I mean a virile and marital one, from which the Euzones of Syria take their name, and also certain Monozonis, concerning which God said to Job, "Gird up thy loins like a man, and give a manly answer." David also glorified that he was girt with the strength of God, and also speaks of God being clothed with strength, and as having girded himself against the impious, unless someone prefers that these words refer to the fullness of his power and its moderation, as in this sense he is said to be clothed with light as with a garment. For who can bear his unveiled majesty in light? What, may I ask, is common to loins and to truth? And what does Paul mean when he says, "Stand therefore having your loins girt about with truth"? Is it that contemplation, perhaps, is to restrain concupiscence and not allow it to be carried elsewhere? For he who is disposed to sensual love has not the same capacity for other delights. And as to shoes, let him who will tread the holy ground trodden by divine feet put off the shoes from his feet, like Moses on the mountain, that he may bring there nothing dead, nothing to come between man and God. Thus must any disciple go who was sent to preach the gospel, frugally and simply, since besides carrying neither money, nor a staff, nor two coats, he should also be without shoes, that his feet may appear beautiful who bears the good tidings and every other good. But he who flies from Egypt and the things of Egypt, let him have shoes on his feet, that he may go unharmed from other things, especially from the serpents and scorpions that abound in Egypt, so that he may not be wounded by those who lie in wait for the heel, and which we are bidden to tread underfoot. Concerning the staff and its meaning, this is what I believe. There is a staff used for support, and another used by shepherds and teachers to correct the sheep that have reason and keep them on the right way. Here the law prescribes a staff to lean on it, that you may not stumble in your mind when you hear of God's blood and of his passion and death, and that you may not wander away from God when you speak of God, but that without hesitation and without shame you may eat the body and drink the blood, if you possess the desire of eternal life, not disbelieving his words concerning his flesh, nor faltering at those of his passion. Lean on this, steadfast and strong, and so prepared you shall be in nothing shaken by your adversaries, nor swept along persuaded by their words. Stand in thy high place, your feet standing in the courts of Jerusalem, firm on the rock, so that you falter not in your steps towards God. What sayest thou? Thus has it pleased him that you should come forth out of Egypt, out of the iron furnace, that you may leave the impious worship of many gods which flourish there, and be led by Moses and by his laws and military rule. I give you certain advice, not mine, or rather mine also if you consider it spiritually. Borrow from the Egyptians vessels of silver and gold. With these begin your journey. Prepare yourself for the road with alien goods, or rather with thy own. The wages of thy servitude are owing to thee. The wages of thy brickmaking, act cleverly for your part in seeking payment. Take plenty. Follow your reason. You have suffered grievous toil there, wrestling with clay, that is, with this difficult and impure body, raising cities, alien to you and fleeting, whose memory perishes with their sound. What then? Shall you come out from there with nothing, without wages? Why so? Will you leave to the Egyptians and to the power of your adversaries what they wickedly acquired, and will spend more wickedly? These things are not theirs. They robbed them. They have sacrilegiously plundered what is his who has said, Thy silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will give it to whomsoever I shall choose. Yesterday they possessed it, for it was permitted them. Today the Lord offers it and gives it to you, that you may use it well unto salvation. Let us make to ourselves friends from the mammon of iniquity, that when we fail, they may receive us in the time of judgment. If you are a Rachel or a Leah, a patriarchal and great soul, steal the idols of your father wherever you find them, not to keep but to destroy them. If you are a wise Israelite, remove them to the land of promise, and let the persecutor grieve over them. And from the deceit practiced on himself, let him learn not to oppress and enslave his betters. If you do this and come out of Egypt, know that you will be guided by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. The desert shall be tamed for you and the sea divided. Pharaoh shall be drowned beneath the waves. It shall rain bread, the rock become a fountain. Amalek overcome, and not by arms alone, but by the conquering hands of the just uplifted in prayer, and forming at the same time the unconquerable sign of the cross. The river shall be cut off, the sun stand still, the moon held back, walls thrown down without the machinery of war. Hornets go before you to make a way for Israel, and hold the Gentiles. All the other events which after these and together with these belong to history, that this account may not be too long, shall happen to you as a favor from God. And such is the feast you celebrate this day, and in this way I would have you, as best you can, celebrate both his birth and his death, who was both born and who died for you. This is the mystery of your Pasch. This is the law foreshadowed, this Christ fulfilled, he who was the destroyer of the letter and the perfecter of the spirit, who in his sufferings taught us how to suffer, and in his glorification enables us to become partakers of his glory. There is something else to be considered, a certain question neglected by many, but which in my opinion should be carefully studied. To whom was that blood offered which was shed for us, and for what purpose was it shed, this great and precious blood of our God, who was both priest and victim? For we were held in bondage by the wicked one, sold under the dominion of sin, receiving instead the pleasure of wickedness. But if the price of redemption is paid to the one who holds the bond, to whom, I ask, was it offered here, and why? If to the wicked one, then alas for the loss of it. If the thief receives, not alone from God, but also God himself as ransom, it would have been more equitable to have saved the payment of so great a price in exchange for his tyranny. But if it was paid to the Father first, how was it done? for we were not held in bondage by him. And again, why should the blood of his only begotten Son be acceptable to the Father? Who would not accept Isaac when he was offered by his father, but instead changed the sacrifice, substituting a ram in place of the rational victim? Is it not plain that the Father accepted it, but that he neither demanded it nor had need of it, but because of the plan of the redemption, and because it was required that man be restored to sanctity by means of the humanity assumed by God, so that tyranny being overcome by a man's strength, he might deliver us and bring us back to himself by means of his Son, who did all this for the honor of the Father, whom in all things he obeys? This we have said of Christ, and more we shall pass over in reverent silence. The brazen serpent that was hung up as a remedy against the serpent's bite was not a figure of him suffering for us, but a contrasting figure. And it healed those who looked upon it, not because it was believed to be living, but because it was believed to be dead, and its power at an end, and also that the power subject to it were dead with it, as was but fitting. But what fitting epitaph shall we sing over it? O death, where is thy victory? O death, where is thy sting? By the cross thou art overthrown. The author of life has brought thee down to death. Thou art lifeless, dead, without movement, inert, though you keep the form of a serpent hanging publicly on high. Let us partake of the pasch, which even now is a figure, though more clear than that of old, for the pasch of the law was, I venture to say, an obscurer figure of the figure. Later it shall be still more perfect, purer, when namely the Word shall drink it with us new in the kingdom of his Father, making plain to us what he now teaches us less clearly. For that is always new which is but now becoming known. What that drink is, and what that enjoyment, it is for us to learn, and for him to teach, sharing his doctrine with his disciples. For teaching is food, and the food of him who teaches. Come then, and let us also be partakers of the law, but not according to its letter, but according to the gospel, not imperfectly, but perfectly, not for a time, but for eternity. Let us have as our capital not the earthly Jerusalem, but the heavenly city. Not that, I say, now trodden under the feet of armies, but that glorified by the angels. Let us not sacrifice lambs, nor young calves, sprouting horns and hooves, of which many parts are dead and without feeling, but let us offer to God a sacrifice of praise upon his heavenly altar, together with his heavenly choirs. Let us pass through the first veil and draw near the second, and look upon the Holy of Holies. And shall I say what is still greater? Let us sacrifice ourselves to God. More, let us sacrifice each day and each action. Let us accept all things for the Word. In suffering, let us imitate his suffering. In blood, let us honor his blood. Let us be prepared to mount even to the cross. Though most painful, yet sweet are the nails. For far more desirable than delight with others is to suffer with Christ, to suffer for Christ. If you are a Simon of Cyrene, take up the cross and follow. If you are crucified together with him as a thief, as a just man, acknowledge thy God. If he, for your sake and because of your sin, was numbered with the wicked, let you then become just for him. Adore him who was crucified for you, though you also be crucified. Make some profit out of your wickedness, with death by salvation. Enter paradise with Jesus, that you may understand from whence thou art fallen. Think of the glories there, and let the murderer and his blasphemies perish without. If you are a Joseph of Arimathea, beg the body from him who crucified it, make yours that which cleanseth us from all sin. If you are a Nicodemus, who worship God by night, anoint him with spices for burial. If you be a Mary, or the other Mary, or a Salome, or a Joanna, weep for him in the early morning. Be first to see the stone roll back, and perhaps you will also see the angels, and even Jesus himself. Say something to him, hear his voice, but should you hear, "Do not touch me," stand afar off. Adore the word, do not grieve, for he knows those by whom he must be seen first. Celebrate the feast of the resurrection. Help Eve, the first to fall, the first to greet Christ, and to tell of him to the disciples. Be like Peter or John. Hasten to the sepulchre, running one against the other, striving in worthy rivalry. And if overtaken, then win by zeal, not stoop down, looking into the sepulchre, but going in. And if, like Thomas, you were not among the disciples to whom Jesus appeared, when you do see him, be not faithless. Or if faithless, at least believe others who tell you of him. And if you do not believe them either, then at least trust the print of the nails. Should he descend into hell, go with him. Learn there also of the mysteries of Christ. What is the purpose of this second descent? What is the plan of it? Appearing there, did he save all? Or there also, those only who believed? And if he ascend to heaven, ascend with him. Be among the angels who accompany him upwards, or among those who receive him. Bid the gates be lifted up, and become higher, that he may enter in who through his passion has become greater. Answer those who doubt because his body now bears the marks of his passion, which he had not coming down, and to those who ask, "Who is this King of glory?" Let you answer, "The Lord who is strong and mighty, both in all that he has ever done and does, and now also in this present battle and triumph for man." To the twofold doubt of the questioner, give a twofold answer. And if they wonder, saying, as in the dramatic words of Isaiah, "Who is this that cometh from Edom, and from earthly things, or how are his garments, who is without body or blood, red like a winepresser, who has trodden the filled winepress? Tell of the loveliness of the garment of his body that suffered, made beautiful by his passion, made glorious by his divinity, that which nothing can be more lovely, nothing more loved." What will these slanderers say to us against this, these bitter opponents of his divinity, those betrayers of everything that is good and praiseworthy, those darkeners of the light, those blind to wisdom, and from whom Christ died in vain, thankless images of the evil one? Do you reproach God for his goodness? Because of this do you belittle him? Because of this is he lowly, because he is the good shepherd, come to seek the sheep that was lost? He who laid down his life for his sheep, who came to the mountaintops where you were wont to sacrifice, and found the erring one and took it upon his shoulders, on which he also bore the cross, and having borne it back, restored it to the life above and placed it among those who had not strayed. Because he lit a candle, his own flesh, and swept the house, cleansing the world of sin and looking for the coin, the royal image defaced with passion, and because the coin was found, he calls together his friends, the heavenly powers, and makes them sharers of his joy, as before he made known to them the divine plan of redemption. Because of this most splendid light follows the light that went before, that the word should come after the voice, crying in the desert, the bridegroom following the bridegroom's friend, preparing for the Lord a people ready, baptizing them in water in preparation for the Spirit. Do you reproach God with these things? Do you think him less because of this? And that he puts on a towel and washes the feet of his disciples, and shows them that lowliness is the best way to become exalted, because he humbles himself to the soul that is bent to the ground, that he may raise with himself the one fallen under sin? How is it you do not accuse him because he eats with publicans, sat at a table with them, made disciples of them, that he also might make a little profit? What profit? The salvation of sinners. If you do then, you must blame the physician for stooping down to the suffering, for enduring evil smells, that he may give health to the sick, and likewise the man who, moved by pity, stoops down that he may, as the law allows, raise the beast fallen into the pit. He was sent, but as man, for he was of two natures, since he hungered and thirsted and was weary and grieved and wept, as nature moved him. And though he was sent as God, what then? Consider his sending as the good will of the Father, to which he refers all that is his, both as honoring his eternal beginning, and lest he should seem opposed to God. For on the one hand it is said of him that he was betrayed, and on the other that he gave himself up, that he was recalled to life by the Father and taken up by him, and again that he raised himself from the dead and that he ascended into heaven. The one relates to the good will, the other to his own authority. You speak only of what lessens him. What exalts him you ignore. You comment on the fact of his suffering, but you do not add that he did so of his own will. And what the Word suffers even now, by some he is honored as God and submerged in him, by others he is despised as flesh and separated from him. With whom shall he be the more angry, or rather, whom shall he forgive? Those who wickedly seek to contract him, or those who wish to lessen him? The one ought to distinguish, the other unite. The one as to number, the other as to divinity. Are you scandalized at his flesh? So also were the Jews. Do you call him a Samaritan, and other things I shall not repeat? Do you deny his divinity? This not even the demons did. In this you go beyond the perversity of the Jews and the incredulity of the demons. The former held that the name Son means equality in rank, and they acknowledged him as God by whom they were driven forth, for they were convinced by what they suffered. But you neither admit his equality nor confess his divinity. It would be better for you, you were circumcised, and even a demon, to say something fantastic, than to think and speak so wickedly, so impiously, while uncircumcised and sound in mind. But this war we wage against such men is best ended by their return, however late, to a better state of mind, if they will. And if they will not, and remain as they are, let it be but for a time. However, we fear nothing, when with the Trinity we fight for the Trinity. We must now sum up our discourse to you. We were created for happiness. We were made happy when we were first made. We were given paradise to enjoy its delight. We received a commandment that obeying it we might win merit, not that he knew not what was to be, but as laying down the law of free will. Through envy we were deceived. We were cast forth because we had broken the law. We hungered because we did not deny ourselves, being defeated and overcome by the tree of knowledge. For the commandment was with us from our beginning, being in a manner an unvarying guide to our soul, and a restraint upon pleasure, and to it we were reasonably made subject, so that we might regain by keeping it what we had lost by not keeping it. That we might live, we needed a God incarnate and dying for us. We died with him, that we might be cleansed of our sin. We rose with him because we died with him, and with him shall we be glorified because we have risen with him. Many indeed are the wondrous happenings of that time, God hanging from a cross, the sun made dark and again flaming out, for it was fitting that creation should mourn with its Creator, the temple veil rent, blood and water flowing from his side, the one as from a man, the other as from what was above man. The earth shaken, the rock shattered because of the rock. The dead risen to bear witness to the final and universal resurrection of the dead. The happenings at the sepulchre, and after the sepulchre, who can fittingly recount them? Yet no one of them can be compared to the miracle of my salvation. A few drops of blood renew the whole world, and do for all men what the rennet does for the milk, joining us and binding us together. But, O Pasch, great and holy, purifier of all the world, for I shall speak to thee as to one living, O Word of God, and light of life and wisdom and power. I rejoice in all thy names, O child of that great mind, its desire and its image. O Word conceived and man beheld, who bearest all things bound together by the power of thy Word. Receive now this our discourse, not as first fruits, but as perhaps the last offering I shall make to thee, as an act of thanksgiving, and as a supplication, that we suffer no affliction beyond the necessary and sacred cares to which we have dedicated our life. Restrain in us the tyranny of the body. Thou seest, O Lord, how great it is, and how it bows me down, or thy own sentence, if we are to be condemned by thee. But should we attain to what we desire, and are received into everlasting dwellings, there also shall we speedily offer thankful gifts to thee, upon thy holy altar, O Father, and Word and Holy Spirit, since to thee belongs all glory, honor, and majesty, through endless ages. Amen. Please go to side B.